From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's restrictive new immigration statutes are causing distress, even among some immigrants with full legal status.
I'm going to get a felony for that? Does that make any sense? My parents paid taxes for 25 years.
Also this week, a push to enshrine abortion rights in Florida's Constitution is underway, but even supporters admit it won't be easy.
It's going to be a multi-million dollar campaign. It will be very expensive to run.
We'll also mark the start of the Atlantic hurricane season and find out why a number of LGBTQ plus community members are sharpening their self-defense skills. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report and the end of week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Hundreds of protesters rallied in cities around Florida this week against the state's new immigration law, WMNF's Josh Holton reports.
Depending on the implementation of this law, is going to be problematic for families.
That is the voice of Democratic State Representative Susan Valdez. She is a first-generation U.S. citizen born to Cuban immigrants, and she grew up in the Bronx before resettling to Florida. She said that other states with similar laws are opting to not enforce it.
So long as you have some sort of documentation that you are here, that's not one of those licenses, which is also problematic because the reciprocity is now in question, if you will, from one state's driver's license to another within the United States.
Valdez said that the result may be instances where people could be charged with a crime that they don't deserve, even if they have all their ducks in a row. Nancy Sileggio was born in Chicago, but has lived in Tampa for 45 years. Her parents are U.S. citizens, but they both immigrated without documentation prior to earning their citizenship. Now she's concerned that driving relatives in and out of the state could result in a felony charge.
I'm going to get a felony for that? Does that make any sense? My parents paid taxes for 25 years.
According to the American Community Survey, immigrants pay nearly $500 billion in taxes, about 15.4% of the total tax revenues governments received from U.S. residents came from immigrant households, while they only made up about 14.8% of all U.S. households. Sileggio says immigrants are essential to the Florida economy.
Our economy depends on the immigrants, of course. Without us, who's going to build your home? Without us, who's going to do your crops? Everybody's going to pay more money for crops. Everybody's going to, if houses are not being built, nobody's going to go eat at the restaurants. It affects everybody.
Under the new law signed by Governor Ron DeSantis, hospitals are required to ask patients about immigration status, and businesses with 25 or more employees must use the federal E-Verify system. In addition, the state has $12 million available to fund the transport of migrants lacking legal status to other states. I'm Josh Holton in Tampa.
Florida is one of about 20 states that allow voters to amend their constitutions. Here, voters have approved amendments like boosting the minimum wage, restoring voting rights to former felons, and banning smoking inside offices. Now WLRN's Veronica Saragovia reports an effort is underway to preserve abortion rights in the Florida Constitution.
Abortion rights supporters recently announced a new political committee called Floridians Protecting Freedom. Its goal? To enshrine abortion rights in the state constitution by getting voters' approval. But first,
we need to collect about 900,000 signatures, and we recognize that this is going to be a huge task.
Kat Dusterhaus founded Bands Off Miami, an abortion rights activist group. They feel optimistic about the huge task ahead because the majority of people in Florida have expressed support for keeping abortion legal.
This is an issue of believing that there should be boundaries with the government and the boundaries being our bodies.
If this effort succeeds, in 2024, voters would be asked to amend Florida's constitution to protect abortion rights through viability, or when a fetus could survive on its own outside of the womb. Nowadays, experts agree viability means about 24 weeks of pregnancy. There would be exceptions if a patient's health was in danger. That's the standard that used to be protected nationwide before the 1973 landmark Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade was overturned last year.
We're so excited to have you for our very first introductory call.
Floridians Protecting Freedom is recruiting volunteers to help collect signatures from registered voters.
The purpose of this training is to help guide volunteer petition collection.
Taylor Aguilera with Planned Parenthood of Southwest and Central Florida hosted a recent online volunteer training. Floridians Protecting Freedom must gather enough signatures in support of this to equal 8% of the votes cast in the last presidential election. And the state requires the signed petition forms to come from half of the state's 28 congressional districts. During the training, Sarah Parker with Women's Voices of Southwest Florida urged volunteers to post on social media.
And take a picture with you and your friends with hashtag abortion on the ballot and tag Floridians Protecting Freedom.
The coalition also has paid staff. A state law passed in 2020 requires non-volunteer petition gatherers to receive a salary or hourly wage. They can no longer be paid based on how many signatures they collect.
Yeah, it's going to be a multi-million dollar campaign. It will be very expensive to run.
Sarah Latshaw is the deputy political director at the ACLU of Florida, which is part of Floridians Protecting Freedom.
We've had an outpouring of support in terms of donations.
So it's very nice to see Miami show up for the right thing.
Last month, supporters of this effort gathered for an event at Griffin Park in North Miami.
Are we going to protect abortion access in Florida?
Yeah.
Awesome. On 2024, we're going to have this for Nevada.
Maite Canino works as the deputy organizing director for the Florida Alliance of Planned Parenthood. She read out the proposed ballot item.
Before viability or when necessary to protect the patient's health, as determined by the patient's health care provider. This amendment.
The Florida Supreme Court would need to approve the wording. Professor Daniel Smith chairs the University of Florida's Political Science Department. He says another challenge happens once you do get an item on the ballot. You need to get enough yes votes from the left, the right, and everyone in between.
That's certainly been the case for the last almost 20 years since we've had an increase to the percentage that is needed to win at the polls, which is 60% plus one votes. You can't get there with just Republicans. You can't get there with just Democrats. You can't even get there with just Democrats and no party affiliates.
In the November 2022 election, voters in Vermont, California, and Michigan supported adding abortion rights to their own state constitutions. Kentucky and Kansas voters also approved ballot measures to protect abortion rights. I'm Veronica Saragovia in Miami.
Governor Ron DeSantis has been signing a bunch of bills since the legislature signee died back on May 5th. But today, the governor vetoed two bills, including a measure that would have added restrictions about titles used by medical professionals and required practitioners to wear name tags or display licenses when treating patients. DeSantis did not detail his reasons in two veto letters that were sent to Secretary of State Cord Byrd. The one bill about medical titles and identification was sponsored by Senate Health and Human Services Appropriations Chair Gail Harrell, a Stuart Republican. She'd argued during the legislative session it would provide transparency to patients. Among other things, the bill could have led to practitioners facing discipline for not wearing name tags or not displaying licenses in their offices. The other bill that DeSantis vetoed dealt with Florida's involvement in the Professional Counselors Licensure Compact. That's a type of agreement that allows telehealth and in-person treatment across state lines. The bill would have backed allowing states to collect fees for practicing under the compact. House sponsor Juan Porras, Republican of Miami, said the proposal was aimed at clearing up an issue after Florida joined the compact last year. Coming up on Capitol Report, some members of the LGBTQ plus community are taking self-defense courses in the wake of state laws they fear will make them even more of a target for violence.
I definitely learned how to protect myself from like chokes, from being abducted, things like that.
Florida A&M University is waging a legal battle against what it says is unfair treatment by the state of Florida.
These young students and whomever else is involved, the reason to file the lawsuit.
The good news, forecasters say there may be fewer hurricanes this year than the recent past. The bad news, it may not matter if even one big storm hits Florida.
But we can say that more intense storms will be more likely.
And as another hurricane season gets underway, one part of Florida is still recovering from last year, and residents there are growing weary.
Some days I'm the windshield, and some days I'm the bug.
June is Pride Month, and Florida's first openly gay senator says this year's commemoration is especially important. More on that story from Regan McCarthy.
In a statement, Miami Gardens Democratic Senator Chevron Jones points out that Pride started as an act of protest, and he says there's plenty to protest after this year's legislative session. During the session, Jones was outspoken against many bills that targeted members of the LGBTQ+ community. Here he is speaking at a press conference on the issues.
How is it in 2023 that we still have to go back to square one as LGBTQ men and women, and as black men and women, as immigrants, men and women, to go back and do the things that we thought people had already fought on our behalf for? But I got a secret for them. While we thought the fight was over, we are committed to continuing the fight.
Jones says it's not easy when he feels like he's debating with his colleagues across the aisle about his right to exist. But he says he'll never stop speaking out. I'm Regan McCarthy.
Free classes are underway in the Tampa Bay region to teach members of the LGBTQ+ community self-defense skills. The effort comes with the passage of some new Florida laws. The Department of Homeland Security also warns threats of violence have increased against the LGBTQ+ community nationally. WUSF Stephanie Colombini visited a recent class at a CrossFit center in Clearwater.
About 30 participants stood in pairs around the gym. They'd take turns. One would pretend to be an aggressor and grab or strike their partner from behind, while the other practiced maneuvers to break free and defend themselves. Great job. Trainers with the company Weapon Brand provided instruction, Found Family Collective, an LGBTQ support group, organized the event. Lakeland resident Noah Lavelle says he showed up because he's worried about his safety in bathrooms now that a law will soon prevent transgender people like him from using many restrooms that match their identity. He uses a wheelchair and says the class boosted his confidence.
I definitely learned how to protect myself from like chokes, from being abducted, things like that, and how to use my wheelchair not as a disadvantage, but as an advantage.
His partner Zoe joined him and asked to only go by her first name for fear of retaliation. She's a teacher in the region and says new education laws aim to silence queer staff. She says this class allowed her to come together with other LGBTQ residents in a supportive environment.
Finding queer spaces within the last 6 months has been so amazing. And so for anyone who like doesn't feel like they have community, like we are out here and like we love you and we want you to come out and just be yourself.
The group plans to host additional classes on rideshare safety in July and active shooter scenarios this fall. I'm Stephanie Colombini in Clearwater.
A potential class action lawsuit alleging state discrimination against Florida A&M, a historically black public university, is moving forward. As Margie Menzel reports, for some, the case is a continuation of the school's long-held tradition of student activism.
The six student plaintiffs argue the state has failed to meet its funding obligations to FAMU and has maintained a, quote, segregated system of higher education, unquote.
We do deserve to be treated equally as those students that are literally across the tracks from us.
Brittany Denton is one of the students represented in the case. In Tallahassee, FAMU's campus and Florida State University's campus are literally divided by railroad tracks. And from Denton's viewpoint, it seems clear one school gets more state support than the other.
it's not fair that we aren't able to get the same opportunities, we aren't allowed to get the same amount of money, we aren't allowed the same education in the same city as another school that has every opportunity in the world.
On Thursday, U.S. District Judge Robert Hinkle heard a motion from the state to dismiss the case, but he's permitting it to proceed. He did, however, pepper the leader of the students' legal team, civil rights attorney Josh Dubin, with questions, and he gave the plaintiffs 30 days to revise the case and provide more specific examples of discrimination. Here's Dubin on the courthouse steps after the hearing.
I'm not a betting man, but if I were, I'd say that they'll probably file another motion to dismiss and we might be back again. Whether there will be oral argument attached to that, I don't know.
The lawsuit raises a series of issues about funding and programs that it contends are discriminatory, including duplication of programs with nearby FSU and an alleged failure to have unique non-core programs at FAMU. Arguments in the case involve such things as an engineering program that FAMU shares with Florida State and a FAMU law school that was closed in the 1960s and revived decades later at an Orlando campus. The closure of the original FAMU law school came as a Florida State law school opened. Dubin doesn't believe that the harm of that juxtaposition has been mitigated.
I don't believe it has. I don't think you undo that sort of stripping of a core academic institution at a historically black college and university.
FAMU President Larry Robinson isn't a party to the lawsuit. During an interview with WFSU after the lawsuit was filed last year, he acknowledged that he walks a fine line between his students and his bosses in state government. But also, he says, social activism is a longstanding tradition at the school.
We have at FAMU some of the nation's most socially conscious and aware students on the planet, okay? And when there are things that they see that don't necessarily go the way that they think they should, then they should step up and say something, right? And so these young students and whomever else is involved, the reason to file the lawsuit.
Brittany Denton says her family and friends have been nothing but supportive.
My family is very proud of the stand that I am able to take. My colleagues are very proud of me, my classmates. They have actually been asking if there's any way that they would be able to get involved even so late into the lawsuit happening.
Denton, a first-year doctoral candidate in pharmacy, says that win or lose, she wants to encourage her fellow students and those who come to FAMU after her.
And I want to say thank you to everyone who has supported me, and especially my mother, Dr. Ora Denton, who has been able to just guide me through exactly how to be the lady that I am to answer these questions that you ask me today.
Dubin and his team are asking Hinkle to certify the case as a class action to represent all of the students enrolled at FAMU during the 2021-2022 school year through the date the judge agrees to do so, if in fact he does. Here's Dubin.
I wish I had as much courage, intellect, and bravery as these students had when I was their age. And I think it speaks volumes about their character, and it's a privilege and an honor to represent them in what we think is a very important historic case.
The lawsuit requests the appointment of a mediator who would recommend a remedy to the court that will allow FAMU to achieve parity with the state's traditionally white institutions within the next 5 years. I'm Margie Menzel.
Hurricane season is underway, along with Florida's sales tax holiday for storm supplies. Rollins College professor Mike Gunter says the amount people spend on hurricane prep varies depending on their most recent exposure to a natural disaster. He spoke with WMFE's Talia Blake.
Why are we seeing more hurricane damage, more flooding damage? And part of that is simply growth and exposure, as you mentioned, more of that along the coast. I mean, when I came here in 2000, the state had 16 million people. We're over 22 million now. But the other factor that's going on is climate change. And so we can't say that there's going to be that any one specific event is because of climate change, but we can say that more intense storms will be more likely.
I'm wondering what people can be doing now to be preparing themselves for a storm that could be coming at any minute now.
You know, be aware where you lie in terms of a floodplain, not just the initial storm, but the rains that can continue sometimes for a day or two afterwards if the storm system stalls. You would also want to make sure that your insurance is up to date. You'd want to protect any kind of important documents in case you do need to file for damages afterwards with insurance. So I think it's about those types of steps. It's a little bit late now to kind of start the rainy day fund, but you're going to have some new expenses, unanticipated expenses, whether it be temporary lodging, food, transportation, if you have to evacuate. So you will need access to some additional funds as well.
Speaking of a rainy day fund, a lot of people were not anticipating having to spend so much in repairs after Hurricane Ian and Nicole. They weren't anticipating to have so much damage. And I'm wondering, you know, on average, how much are people paying out of pocket for hurricane repairs and damage?
I saw some data that in terms of just minimal damages, historically, 4,000 is a figure. In terms of more moderate damages, 10,000 is a figure.
Earlier, you were saying that, you know, one of the things that contribute to how much people prepare for a hurricane is what they experienced in the last hurricane season. So I'm wondering, are there any other factors that contribute into what makes someone decide to prepare, how much they prepare for a hurricane?
First off, there's a degree of affordability. You know, this is a question that's been driving climate change discussion for over three decades now, is can we afford to do this? Why should we spend this money now? Well, that is an important question to ask, but there's another important question that sometimes doesn't get asked, and that is, can we afford not to, right? It says, if you don't do this, what does that mean in terms of future expenses? And there's research out there that shows that every dollar spent on preparation actually prevents $6 in future expenses. So yes, it means spending money, but spending money can save money.
That was Rollins College professor Mike Gunter speaking with WMFE's Talia Blake. Mental health organizations that serve the Fort Myers Beach community are ready to lend a hand to residents. They hosted a resiliency roundup this week, and WGCU's Carrie Barber was there.
For many Fort Myers Beach residents whose homes and businesses were damaged or destroyed by Hurricane Ian, it's hard to believe that June 1st brings the beginning of another hurricane season already. Many are still struggling, still lacking a permanent place to live, waiting for insurance money, and grappling with the damage to their mental health that arrived with the 150-mile-an-hour winds last September 28th. Corey Francisco was a 30-year resident of Fort Myers Beach. She went to a neighbor's house for the storm.
We stayed on my street. I didn't really think it was going to be a big deal. I left my purse at my house. I figured I'll be back in a few hours.
She watched in horror as her neighbor's houses floated by. Her home survived, but she was a renter and the owner sold. She has yet to find permanent housing back on the island. Susan Carter, also a 30-year resident, lost her Fort Myers Beach home in the storm just 2 months after her husband died. Her mental state is up and down, she says.
Some days I'm the windshield and some days I'm the bug.
But she continues to teach yoga on Zoom because having to show up for her students helps her feel better.
That's what's going to get us all through this, is being of service to others. Could you forget thinking about yourself all the time?
The ravages of Hurricane Ian have taken a toll on the psyches of residents. Research shows that people who come through a natural disaster such as a hurricane frequently develop some sort of mental distress, including PTSD, depression, anxiety, trouble sleeping, and a desire to isolate. Among the deaths from Hurricane Ian, official Lee County sources count at least four suicides, all of whom were people over 65. This week, Park Royal Hospital in Fort Myers, along with other service providers, sponsored a resiliency roundup to help residents gain access to the myriad mental health resources available to them. More than 20 care providers were at the roundup, which was held at the Diamond Head Beach Resort on Fort Myers Beach. Among them were Satlas Care, a mental health and substance abuse care provider, which closed after Hurricane Ian, but officially reopened in mid-May. FMB Strong is a nonprofit that hosts a food pantry and distributes other supplies. The Children's Advocacy Center helps children exposed to abuse or neglect, and one of several therapy dogs at the event was padding around their table. Therapy horses from Horsepower for Healing in Punta Gorda stood outside the hotel, ready to soothe. Many of the services are offered for free or on a sliding scale. Fort Myers Beach resident Deb Dill is back in her home and grateful. She explains why she came for the roundup.
I just thought that whenever new resources are offered in the community, we need to continue to support it. And you never know when you walk into something like this where you're going to find the right person that's going to do something to help your journey move along.
Park Royal staff hopes to take the Resiliency Roundup on the road to help all the hardest-hit areas of Lee County. In the meantime, the service providers are available for anyone who needs help. If you need help or have a loved one who does, contact any of the providers named here or call the United Way's 211 line for local resources. The nationwide suicide crisis line is available by calling 988. I'm Carrie Barber with additional reporting by Andrea Melendez in Fort Myers Beach.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, two sea animals rescued after being affected by red tide off Florida's west coast are now back in the Gulf. WGCU environmental writer Tom Bayless tells their story.
A pair of sea turtles found dazed and confused in Sarasota County a few months ago are now back in the Gulf of Mexico, feeling better and doing whatever loggerhead turtles do all day. The pair were found within days of each other in February, both lethargic and showing some signs of red tide's toxic effects, such as struggling to breathe, disorientation, or sores on their flippers. The turtles were cared for by Sarasota's Moat Marine Laboratory and Aquarium's Sea Turtle Rehabilitation Hospital and the Florida Aquarium's Sea Turtle Rehabilitation Center in Apollo Beach. The pair joins another set of loggerheads with the same conditions who were released 2 weeks ago. Red tides off Sarasota, Charlotte, Lee, and Collier counties had been a near constant fixture since the rainfall from September's Hurricane Ian washed tons of nutrients into the Gulf of Mexico. Much of the nutrient pollution is nitrogen and phosphorus from fertilizer. The chemicals don't create a red tide bloom, but scientists have proven the same stuff used to make grass or corn grow can feed a fledgling red tide bloom, causing it to become stronger and last longer than it otherwise might. In Fort Myers, I'm Tom Bayless.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Valerie Crowder, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Margie Menzel. Thanks also to Josh Halton, Veronica Saragovia, Stephanie Colombini, Talia Blake, Carrie Barber, and Tom Bayless. Technical assistance for Capital Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.